Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, The Future Was Now, a fascinating new book all about the crazy summer of 1982, when 8 of the most successful movies of all time were released in an 8-week period and changed Hollywood forever. I talked to the co-creator and director of the much-talked-about Irish-language movie Kneecap, Rich Pepiat. Plus, Niamh O'Reilly reviews The Return of Alien and Mark Wahlberg and Halle Berry in The Union on Netflix. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. And I was off last week. We featured some of our highlights of the year so far. I was off sunning myself or being rained on, depending on what day it was, on the Aran Islands, and a mighty fine time I had too. I was also on a flight between the three islands, which was a lovely experience, courtesy, well, I was paying customer, courtesy of Air Aran. Lovely, sunny, windy day between the three islands. And I'm a slightly nervous flyer, I have to say. I had an incident in my 30s somewhere over the Atlantic when there was terrible turbulence to the point that people were screaming. And I haven't been quite right since. Now, it doesn't stop me going anywhere or anything like that, but I don't really enjoy it. That said, I was on this Air Aran plane, which is a 9-seater, and it was very safe, don't get me wrong, and lovely staff, and my son got to sit with the pilot up front, but it's very small. It's like a van with wings, and it doesn't go very high. And I feel like I've cured my late-blooming fear of flying, because if I was able to get through this, I'll be fine on my next big 747 plane or whatever it is I'll be flying on, because we bounced around the sky in what felt like a van with wings. But it was glorious views and hairy for me, but perfectly safe and absolutely delightful. This was a very small plane, so I'm looking forward to getting on a big one again in the future. And I think, as I say, it's cured my fear of flying. So that was me. I do hope you're well. Now, I want to quickly mention the sad passing of the legendary actress Gina Rowlands. She was, I suppose, primarily known for incredible performances in films she did with her husband, John Cassavetes. And I'm thinking in particular of a movie called A Woman Under the Influence, where she plays a woman really struggling with her mental, emotional health. And it is a powerhouse of a performance. Fortunately or unfortunately, a lot of people remember in The Notebook, which wasn't a bad performance, but that's a strange movie of sorts. She was also brilliant in a Woody Allen movie called Another Woman, not one of his kind of better known ones, where she plays this emotionally uptight, let's say, philosophy professor. A brilliant, brilliant actress, and she passed away this week at the age of 94. So I just want to mention that. And if you were going to watch one thing with her in, watch A Woman Under the Influence opposite Peter Falk, who plays her husband in it. So RIP the great Gina Rowlands. Undoubtedly, the biggest story in Irish cinema this year has been Kneecap. It was released last week, but as I bored you with earlier, I was on holidays, but I did want to talk about it because I did see it. I saw it back in May at a special screening for very important people like me. And in case you don't know, it is the origin story of sorts, albeit a fictionalized one in some capacities, of the Northern Irish language hip hop band Kneecap. And of course, we have Moglai Bap, DJ Provy, and Mokara are their stage names. They play themselves, which is kind of remarkable. To me, it is shades of Train Spotting, even The Commitments, if I may be so bold. And there are politics involved. But first and foremost, what I'd like to say is it's wildly, wildly entertaining, which is what you want from a movie. It was conceived and directed by Rich Pepiat, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Rich, how are you?
Very good, man. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So listen, and forgive me, I know you've been doing this a while, so if some of these questions you've been tired of talking about, but there are just some really pertinent ones. And I'm wondering, I heard the lads talking and they were saying, you know, you came along and they weren't necessarily buying it. They thought, this guy, you know, he wants to do a movie or whatever. And then they realized you were serious about it and you had a kind of fully realized story of sorts. But I'm wondering, when you first saw them, What was it that made you think there is a movie and a good movie in this?
Well, my first thought was the rational part of my brain was that an unsigned local act had never released an album and were rapping in a language not many people spoke. Rationally did not scream Hollywood hit, right? And then there was this creative part of my head was going, the reason why it's quite interesting is because it makes no sense whatsoever. And I think the biopic genre is one that's been sort of run over 100 times now. And the idea of sort of doing a biopic rather than looking back on a career of a musician or whatever when they're dead or old, what about you did it in real time as they're coming up? Is that even possible? And what sort of shape would that take? And so they were sort of the initial thoughts. And I think above and beyond that, you know, they were great. I was very impressed by them as an act. But I was also really intrigued by the audience because, you know, the first gig that I saw of theirs, there was 800 or so young people in the crowd who were rapping every word of Irish they were speaking back to them. And it was a bit of a revelation to me as someone who'd just moved to Belfast, but had been going there for, you know, 10 years before, that there was this young, vibrant kind of grassroots community of Irish speakers. And I was like, okay, because at the time we had the Irish Language Act, which was very slowly passing through Stormont and you know, the political stasis that was happening in the North versus this vibrant, energetic grassroots movement just felt like a really interesting kind of precinct to set a film.
Yeah. And tell me this, you know, the success of it, like you've mentioned it there that you didn't think, you know, you're not sitting down conceiving I'm going to have this world beating movie. It seems so kind of niche, but you must be surprised by the lengths it's gone to. Sundance, Ireland's Oscar nomination, all this kind of stuff. Like, I'm sure in your wildest dreams you never conceived it was going to be like this.
We set out to make this film really for Gaelgors in Belfast. That was
which is a niche enough audience.
Yeah, well, look, it was, you know, we really, when I first approached the lads, I said, look, I'm going to make this. It was never a question of, you know, I want to make this film. It was like, I'm going to make this film and, you know, I'll try and get some money together. But if we have to shoot it on our iPhones, we'll do it like that. Do you know what I mean? If it has to be stuck out on YouTube, we'll do it like that. So the ambition was fairly modest to start with. And you know, it just sort of gained momentum. And I think that one of the things about this biopic in real time idea was the band kept getting bigger, right? And they kept improving. And it was a risk for them, right, to do a film because obviously the film had been rubbish. It would have affected their street cred a bit. But also it was a risk for me as a filmmaker and you know, all the funders, etc. Because, you know, bands break up all the time. Brands reach a point where they plateau, especially when they're kind of a local band, right? It's like, are they going to get better? Are they going to stay together for 5 years for us to make this film? And, you know, it all could have fallen apart. But the serendipity of it all sort of, you know, their debut album coming out the same summer that the film's coming out, we never could have done that when we set out on it. You know, that was kind of almost the goal, I think, was like, we can kind of do these things together and build together. But, you know, it has come together amazingly. And you know, 2 weeks ago, I was sitting on a plane to LA with the lads so we could go to the US press tour. And I looked at my phone and I'd set up a WhatsApp group when I first started talking to them in September, I think, 2019. And I called that WhatsApp group jokingly, Kneecap Goes to Hollywood. And there we were, sitting on a plane on our way to Hollywood. And it was just kind of like, we raised a wee glass and we're like, yeah, Sláinte.
Wow. And listen, you know, it's probably people like me who ask you about this kind of stuff and it's probably of no consequence, but in terms of, you know, fact and fiction, what is it loosely based on, all that kind of stuff? Like we have, you know, DJ Provy, who was a school teacher in real life, apparently, and that's what the character is in this one. Michael Fassbender's character, he's christening one of the lads on a, I think it's called a rock christening because they had to do it in secret and stuff like that. There's some cross-border sex going on, if you will, or cross religious sex. Like, in terms of how much of this is real and how much it wasn't, is, like, even as I'm asking you this, I'm thinking, this is unimportant. Why am I asking you this? Like, how much of the guys' lives did you actually use?
Look, a lot of it's real. Some of the mad stuff in the film is the real stuff. It's some of the more sort of boring stuff of binding the story together in a kind of you know, 100 odd minutes. It's a tri-protagonist film. The lads were very adamant from the very start. They all needed to be, you know, equal to the film. No one could be like a walk-on part. So that presented a challenge, is how you do sort of a tri-protagonist film. And so that required a little bit of massaging. But for me, I think that I always think about a film like Fargo, right? And the first one, you know, the opening lines that come up in Fargo is every word in this film is true out of respect for the dead, right? And not a word of that film by the Coen brothers was true. It was completely made up, right? But, you know, the Coen brothers obviously said to themselves, look, what is our duty here? Our duty is to entertain. And we think this story we want to tell works better if the audience believe it to be true, okay? And so that's something that weirdly just always stuck with me. And I think it was a philosophical question then about, well, how much when you're doing a biopic do you need to stick to the plain facts, and how much can you twist those facts a bit to up the entertainment value? And, you know, so there are moments that we sort of gave it an extra bit of spin just to, you know, make it funnier, make it whatever. But also the other thing is, it's an amalgamation of stories from the community, right? So it's like, it's not all of the things in the film necessarily happened to the boys in that order. A lot of them did, but there's certain stories in there which are stories that you've heard down the pub, right? Or you know, we're sitting in a bar and they're telling about a mate of theirs. And so it's kind of, you know, as much as the film is about Kneecap the Band, I think one thing we're really proud of is that it feels, to the people of Belfast particularly, you know, it's a story of the community. It's a story of them as, you know, as people. And, you know, I think hopefully that comes across.
Yeah. And just on that, and I leave the whole did this not happen behind now, but it's either Nisha or Lee Moog, who apparently was christened outdoors, and it's the opening shot in the movie with a RUC helicopter patrolling. That happened, I gather.
Absolutely. I mean, that was, I remember sitting in the pub with the boys not long after I first met them, and, you know, Nisha told that story, and I was like, you're kidding me. You're pulling me leg. And like, you know, and he pulled out a newspaper article from, you know, the early 90s, which was on his phone, of actually what happened. And so, you know, I was instantly then, I was like, well, that's the start of the film right there. And, you know, so it screamed, you know, opening of the film. And there was lots of moments like that that I often say that kind of putting together the film was like the world's longest interview. You know, I used to be a journalist on a time, and it was like 6 months of basically sitting in boozers, you know, just getting to know them and just mining them for all the stories of their lives, and not in a kind of interrogatory way, but just how, if you're sitting in the pub with friends, how stories come out. You sit there and you tell stories, and it was just like, you know, over the course of that time, I sort of came out of it with enough. I was like, right, I just need to piece this together in a way that makes sense, and here we are.
It's dirty work, but someone has to do it, sitting in a pub with the Kneecap boys. Well, you certainly pulled it off. Tell me this, you know, I often think about the example of Vietnam, that, you know, the first time I heard about Vietnam, I remember hearing a Billy Joel song, Goodnight Saigon, then a Bruce Springsteen song, Born in the USA, and then Oliver Stone made a movie and blah, blah, blah. And it was like 10 years after Vietnam had ended. And it's almost like, you know, it's like the world has to catch up or something. Do you think a movie like this had to be post the Good Friday Agreement? And I know things are not by any means plain sailing in the North, but they are, by any quantifiable metric, a lot better than they were, say, when I was a child in the 80s. Do you think you couldn't have made this movie 20 years ago, or was the time right for this, do you think? Or is that too big a sociological question to be asking about a fun movie?
No, I don't think so. I think that one of the things about Kneecap that I was always really impressed by was they were out there in their music saying things that had never been said before. And as someone whose filmmaking sensibility likes controversy and believes that controversy is an important thing in art, and it's like about opening up a space for discussion. And sometimes, you know, there's a lot of sacred cows in the North sometimes, and there's a lot of trauma from what has occurred, but sometimes that trauma is exacerbated by the fact that people don't talk about things. It's all brushed under the carpet. And, you know, I believe, and I know Kneecap believe, that was something we bonded over, the idea that people need to talk about things. It needs to be out in the open. And one way of talking about things is the dark comedy of it. Do you know what I mean? It's telling jokes. And they were always big on that. out of telling jokes about things that were very, very dark. But equally, there's a tonic in that, there's a healing in that. And, also I think there's something to be said for the fact that I'm not sure an Irish man or woman necessarily could have made this film, because, I think that it would have been seen perhaps as anti-British or sectarian. And I think we're quite Teflon from that accusation, because you know what I mean? Like, I'm Irish as well, but I've got a British passport, and it's like, it does kind of stop the Daily Mail being able to sort of, well, they do try and accuse it of being anti-British, of course.
But, yeah, they do.
Like, what the Daily Mail wants to believe Britishness is, isn't necessarily what I believe Britishness is. And I think Britishness is about, holding your hands up and recognising our imperial past, recognising our colonial shameful nature of what we've done, and there's no, that's also part of Britishness, I think.
And so just on that, I mean, whatever about it being anti-British, and you can debate that, and I think certainly the fact that you are, you have a British passport, as you say, it certainly circumvents that to a certain extent, but you could definitely argue that it's anti-loyalist. Is your argument back to that, what, you're just making jokes?
Well, to be fair, that there's plenty of slagging in the direction of loyalists, but there's plenty of slagging in the direction of Republicans as well.
Yeah, true.
I think we're equal opportunity sleggers. there's always something for people to get offended by if they want to be offended. But offense is always a choice, right? If you choose to get offended. And so I have very little sympathy for that idea. No one's forcing you Clockwork Orange style to sit there and watch the film, right? And that, if you don't like it, speak with your money and don't turn up or leave, right? And so that ultimately the film's out there in the world, and we're not really getting that feedback. Do you know what I mean? Of course, if some people don't like it, that's fine, absolutely. Like, no one's gonna like everything, but we're not finding that the people from all sections of the community are going to the film and are enjoying it. And I think that is also speaks to just, the humour of Ireland as a people that, I love so dearly, is that everyone really, has an ability to laugh at themselves a bit, right? I think that's an important part of Ireland's personality, is being able to have a joke and laugh at yourself. And I think if people want to have a humour failure, then that reflects more on them than it does the film.
Well, you're preaching to the converted. And listen, finally then, Rich, what's next for you? Because it's kind of a fascinating career you've had. You were a journalist. I know you've done some other movies. This was your first feature-length narrative film. What when all this settles, what are you thinking of next? Or maybe you can't say.
Lie down for a long time. And there's a couple of things. So, it's been a great experience, and certainly opened some doors for me. But a difficult second album coming up. Your top kneecap, do you know what I mean? So I've got a couple of things bubbling away, but look, Ireland's my home. The Irish film industry is something that I have a huge amount of love for and want to stay in and keep working in, and there's a lot of Irish stories here to be told. I've set up a production company in the north with producer Trevor Burney called Coup de Tat, and look, we're going to be making more films. That's the plan.
Okay, more films, but you haven't told me anything about that, what next film is, but that's completely fine.
Journalist in me, you see, is it skipping around the question?
Absolutely, you do it with aplomb. Well, listen, apart from that, you answered everything with forthrightness. I do appreciate it. I've been talking to Rich Pepiat, who is the creator, well, co-creator, I think it's fair to say, along with the lads from Kneecap and the director of Kneecap. He's kindly taken time out of his holiday to talk to me, which I greatly appreciate. You should go and see Kneecap, because it is a trip and a half. Rich, lovely to talk to you. Thanks a million.
You too, pal.
You've heard of intergenerational trauma, right?
Right.
Our history.
Our history has become our biology. It's like the trauma our ancestors suffered.
Has inserted itself.
Has actually inserted itself into our genetic code. Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Psychological
reverberations. ADHD. ODD.
The troubles?
I've got... troubles.
A trippy clip there from Kneecap, which of course is still on general release, and it's going gangbusters in the cinema, and rightly so. And you heard me talking there to Rich Pepiat, its director and co-creator, conceiver, if you will. And as I say, it was nice of him to talk to me from his holidays. Up next, the fascinating summer of 1982 and how it changed Hollywood forever. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. The future was now, Mad Men Mavericks, and the epic sci-fi summer of 1982 is a new book that chronicles, well, a pretty astonishing 8-week period in movie history when 8 science fiction and fantasy movies were released within 8 weeks of each other. Those films were E.T., Blade Runner, Tron, The Road Warrior, let's call it Mad Max 2, The Thing, Conan the Barbarian, Star Trek The Wrath of Khan, and Poltergeist. Guys, the book charts how these films help set the stage for high concept movies that had a mad, rabid fan base, merchandising potential, and of course sequels. And in a way, these 8 movies changed the face of Hollywood forever. Chris Nashawaty is a writer and former film critic at Entertainment Weekly, and previously wrote a book all about Caddyshack called Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. And I'm delighted to say he joins me from the West Coast of America. Chris, hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, John?
Very well. So listen, I nearly had to check this. Not that I didn't believe you, but the idea in the age we live in now where, like, you know, one movie requires a campaign by a studio that can, you know, as you well know, sometimes take years. So these 8 movies all in an 8-week period just seems preposterous. Was that what fascinated you about this? That how on earth did this come to pass?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it is very fluky and weird, as you say. It wasn't all 8 that originally fascinated me. It was actually just 2 of them. Blade Runner and The Thing by John Carpenter both opened on June 25th, 1982, the same day. And what interested me about that was, why are these 2 science fiction movies that are now classics opening on the same exact day? But also that when they first came out, they were both critically sort of reviled and also commercially did not connect with audiences. So it sort of fascinated me that these 2 movies that are now regarded as part of the sci-fi canon were not initially accepted. And the deeper I dug into it, the more I saw all of these other films popping up in the same summer. And I thought, my gosh, why is this?
Yeah, and I think it's funny in your book you talk about June 25th being like the darkest day in film criticism because people like Pauline Kael really tore into some of those movies. Tell me this though, what I found fascinating about the book was that in a way so much of it goes back to Star Wars and possibly Jaws, and you might go, yeah, but that was 5 years beforehand, but it's almost like, as you well know, again, it takes a long time to make a movie that studios were catching up to the success of Star Wars.
That's exactly right. I mean, studios are a bit like battleships. They take a very long time to turn around and steer in a different direction. And when Star Wars came out in 1977, it really surprised, the studios. They just weren't expecting it to be such a sensation, such a phenomenon. And as soon as it happened, they thought, you know, well, we need to have our own science fiction movie as well. So it's really that chase for the next blockbuster. That's really the premise of the book. And, the development of these 8 films, and they take 5 years to go from we need this to, okay, now we're going to put this in theaters.
Yeah. And so in a way, was it just a traffic jam? I mean, I presume all these different studios weren't thinking the summer of 82 is going to be when we rewrite cinema.
It's a little bit of a blind spot for them. It's interesting that now, obviously, scheduling movies, especially big tentpole movies, is such a science. But back in the early 80s, it was really, there wasn't that thinking. It just wasn't, the whole concept of the blockbuster was very, very novel. So, they hadn't really perfected the art of scheduling yet. So you've got this real traffic pileup in the summer of 1982, all of these studios responding to the same thing and coming up with their response to it at the same exact time.
And it might interest you to know, Chris, but there used to be a thing, and it was probably up until maybe only 10 years ago, but European audiences, and I can only speak really about Irish and English ones, but we used to have to wait sometimes 3 to 6 months for these blockbusters. Now, I was, because they were released at different times. So I was only, what age was I? 6 or 7, something like that, when these were having the blockbuster summer. But these movies, like E.T. and stuff, didn't come to us largely till late 82 and early 83. You were probably aware of that, but I just, I'm Irishing it up slightly for you.
It's interesting that you were 6 that summer, and I was curious if you watched any of these movies, because I was 13 in the summer of 1982, and I saw all of these movies in the theater, and it really was sort of a miraculous time, and I wonder if you had the same experience.
Well, what I did see late that year, or maybe it was the summer of 83, memory's a funny thing, but was E.T. And I couldn't get over it. I really couldn't. Just how wonderful it was. I mean, I'd seen Empire Strikes Back and that blew my mind. I was probably far too young to see it, but E.T. really did. But tell me, right, I suppose the deeper point of the book in a way is when we look at those movies, and to my mind, 7 out of 8 of them are miraculous. I can probably leave Conan the Barbarian outside that list, to be honest. But I get its cultural significance. But they're all sci-fi, fantasy, maybe one of them slightly horror. Like, this was a new era in that, you know, we had the punt of Star Wars, which paid off. But this changed Hollywood, because suddenly niche storytelling, if you want to call it that, like stories about aliens, stories about science fiction, were front and center. And we can, where we're living now in terms of Hollywood movies, there's a direct line. Like, it changed cinema utterly this summer of 82.
Absolutely. And I think that the real sort of like nub of the argument in the book is that this was really the first time that Hollywood began listening to the audience instead of vice versa. It was a moment when it was really the birth of fan culture, which of course now is the dominant force in Hollywood. Now it seems like Hollywood just makes movies for fans, and you know, superhero movies and sequels.
Yeah.
But back then this was sort of a new idea. You know, Hollywood would put out movies, and you know, you just went to them. That was what was there. And if you didn't like them, you were out of luck. So this was the first time that they really discovered this untapped audience of mostly young males who would go see a movie not once, but maybe 3 or 4 times. So it was just a real shift in the audience.
Yeah. Now, we could go down a rabbit hole of discussing, you know, whether where we are now is so much worse than 1982 or whatever. And I don't want to be, you know, old man River arguing with the sky or whatever, but I can't help thinking, looking at your book, that you think 1982 was a much better time for cinema than 2024 is. But I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me, based on your book, that there was so little planning and that there was people who had stories they were burning to tell. Now, of course, there were studios who wanted to make lots of money, but there seems to be such a science, a financial science to movie making now, that there wasn't in 1982. But you tell me.
Well, I think you're right. You notice something between the lines of the book that is there, and that's a sense of nostalgia. I do feel that there are elements of the movie-going experience and also the movies that are made back then that aren't there today, and I think we're poorer for it. I do think that, you know, it's interesting. In 1982, the movies, Hollywood was in a similar crisis to the one that they're in right now, and the impulse of the studios back then was to take these gambles, these risks, let the artists tell the stories that they want to tell, and let's bet on them, and hopefully it'll work out. Now, in some cases it did. Obviously, E.T. was the biggest movie of all time. But, you know, now I feel like Hollywood is sort of curling into a fetal ball and hoping the problem goes away, making safe movies, when they really should be, this is a moment they should be taking risks and letting artists tell stories. But it's just, it feels very cookie cutter to me. And maybe I'm old man River shouting at the sky, but you know, such is life.
Indeed, indeed. What's great about the book, aside from that, is there's just great stories about these 8 movies, and we don't have time to get into to the mall, and you talk about E.T. and how, you know, Spielberg was really harnessing his childhood and his unhappy childhood, and that's beautifully dealt with. But the Poltergeist thing is fascinating because he was kind of, or you tell me though, he was contractually obliged not to make that because he was already directing something else. So Hooper, the director of Chainsaw Massacre, does Poltergeist. But there's a lot of argument to this day about who's actually directing Poltergeist. And Steven Spielberg in your book kind of tells you, well, it's kind of me. Or is that a fair assessment?
I think it's pretty fair. I mean, look, this is a man who's a, you know, a Boy Scout in Hollywood. He's got a sterling reputation. And if there was ever a moment that he had a bit of a black eye, it was in 1982. This was a period in his career where he was burning to tell stories and work. You know, he was really driven. Yeah. And, you know, while he was making E.T., he had this idea for Poltergeist. The Directors Guild in Hollywood does not allow a director to make two movies at the same time. So he had to find another director for Poltergeist. As you mentioned, he picked Tobe Hooper, who had directed the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And Steven was on the set almost every day of the making of Poltergeist. And, you know, just as a producer, he had also co-written the script. The script was very personal to him. And, you know, there was a lot of debate and a lot of, you know, rumor mill coming from the set that Steven was actually the one who was calling the shots, action and cut on the set. Now, depending on who you talk to, you know, accounts differ. But my sense is that he was a very strong producer and, you know, maybe exerted his influence more than a normal producer would. While Tobe Hooper was a, you know, a relative, he was his first studio film, and maybe he was deferential to Steven Spielberg.
And tell me, I slagged off Conan, and I shouldn't have really, but what I found fascinating in your book was just the state of Oliver Stone at the time, because he was the screenwriter of Conan, people might forget, but to the point that he was off his head on mushrooms and brought Schwarzenegger around to the apartment that he was staying in to get him to recite dialogue from comics of the 70s.
Yeah, this is Oliver Stone to me is a really interesting character. And by the way, it's okay that you don't like Conan the Barbarian. I happen to love it, but that's, you know, to each his own.
But you know what? I haven't seen it in about 30 years, so I could be completely wrong, you know?
I don't know if it's going to get any better for you. But anyhow, Oliver Stone was just coming off winning an Oscar for writing the screenplay for Midnight Express. So he was really hot at the time. He was also a little bit into drugs at the time. He was, you know, taking cocaine and mushrooms and things like that. It was, you know, he's very open about discussing it. And if you go and read the script, his original script for Conan the Barbarian, which is like, you know, like 300 pages long. I mean, it's just insane. It's written by someone who is obviously staying up all night, you know, burning the candle at both ends. And it's got, you know, alien monsters and things that aren't in the movie and would never be in a movie. And they actually put a budget on the script that he wrote at the time, and it was $60 million. And at the time, no movie had been made for more than, you know, $20, $25 million. It was just absurd. So they had to, you know, change the script. But Oliver Stone really was the driving force behind the movie at a really interesting chapter in his life. Obviously, he would go on to, with the success of Conan, you know, get some of the cachet he needed to make his most personal film, Platoon. So it's just a really interesting chapter for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And an interesting chapter in your book, as are all the chapters. All of this and many, many more stories are contained in a fantastic read, The Future Was Now, Mad Men, Mavericks, and the epic sci-fi summer of 1982, where, as I say, a staggering 8 movies were released in 8 weeks, and they included everything from E.T. to Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, which we didn't even talk about. But I wanted to talk to you finally, Chris, was about your last book, Caddyshack. And again, I remember watching Caddyshack in college. But the idea of wanting to make a book all about that kind of irreverent golfing movie, why did you do that? Now, I haven't read it, but I presume there's a big story there if you wanted to write a book about it.
Yeah, it's one of those movies. I love the movie, but, you know, it's one of those movies where the making of story is way better than the movie itself. You know, you've got, it's really the moment when this whole next generation of comedy comes to the fore and breaks into Hollywood. you know, sort of gets through the studio gates and sort of makes a mess of it. The fact that the movie exists is miraculous when you read about it. There's so much cocaine going on during the making of the movie. There are so many great personalities. You know, Bill Murray, the wild card, and it really is a moment when the talents behind Saturday Night Live, the Second City Improv Group, and the National Lampoon magazine all come together and take Hollywood by storm.
Oh, fascinating. So it's kind of a launch pad. Well, listen, that will have to be on my to-read list as well. Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. I've been talking to that author, Chris Nashawaty, but more importantly, his book, which is available, I'm assuming, Chris, on Amazon for Irish people to get. It is called The Future Is Now, Mad Men, Mavericks, and the Epic Sci-Fi Summer of 1982. Chris, a pleasure to chat to you.
Thank you very much, John.
Chris Nashawaty there, talking to me about his book, The Future Was Now. Up next, The Return of Alien. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases, and chief among them are Alien Romulus. Aliens, whichever you want to say, is back for, I think it's the 8th installment in this long and varied franchise. We're also going to be talking about a new Netflix movie starring Mr. Wahlberg and Halle Berry in The Union. Delighted to be joined now by freelance writer and movie critic Niamh O'Reilly. Niamh, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
How's your summer going?
Oh, well, yeah, hit and miss weather-wise, but there's been a lot of good movies. So
indeed there have. Indeed there had. Now, are there going to be good movies this week? Let's find out. Alien Romulus, as I said, the 8th, I think, or the 7th or the 8th, one of those in the Alien franchise, not directed by Ridley Scott, but from his production house.
That's right. Yeah, so his fingerprints are on this and he has kind of given it his blessing. So that's always a good thing. So this is what's frustratingly referred to as an interquil. Yeah. So it's just sickening.
Just what the world needs.
We need another,
variation on sequels and prequels. And
no, it's desperate.
So interquil. Sorry. Yeah.
So it basically, it just means it's set in the time period between Alien 1 and Aliens, Alien 2. So it's in that sort of time period, about 20 years or so after the events of the first film.
Right.
And we're focusing in on Kaylee Spaney's character, Rain. And she lives on this really oppressive mining planet that has no hours of daylight. And she's in service, basically, to the company, Weyland-Yutani Company, the very evil sort of company that we know very well from this Alien franchise. Her parents worked there. They died there because of lung conditions. It's an awful place. She's desperate to leave with her adopted brother, Andy, who is slightly vulnerable, let's just say. And I don't want to say too much about him, but he has some other sort of technical abilities, let's just say. And I'm not going to go into any more about him or his origins, but he's very tech savvy. So they want to leave. They're not allowed. And then Rain gets sort of in touch with her ex-boyfriend, Tyler, and their group of young people. And they have found a wrecked space station floating above the planet.
Okay.
And on this space station, there's some cryo tubes. So their plan is to get up there, salvage the cryo tubes and leave this horrible planet for a better life.
And the cryo tubes would enable them to leave this.
Because it would take, I don't know, 9 or 10 years to get to this other solar system that they want to get to, so they could sleep through it.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, when they get up there, the xenomorph is there, which is the alien.
Yeah.
And lots of fun ensues. And
okay.
That's the basic setup.
And so if you go back like to the original Alien and then also Aliens, you know, the famous tagline, no one can hear you scream in space. They were creepy. They were kind of almost space horrors of sorts. Is it of that ilk?
100%. Now, this was a very frustrating film. The first three quarters were almost pitch perfect.
Okay.
Director Fede Alvarez, who you might know, directed the Evil Dead remake back in 2013 and the two Don't Breathe films. The first one of those is fantastic. I think it really went under the radar. If you haven't seen it, go look at it. He's a great horror director and he knows how to build dread and use it really effectively. And he does that here. And you feel like he's also a real fan of the original Aliens films, one and two in particular. And he really does a great job of sitting this film tonally and narratively right in that time period. I mean, this looks like a film that could have been made in the mid-80s.
Okay.
It fits right in with the look and the tone. The levers, the buttons, the sweat, the dirt, the grime, the fact that you think you could take a wrench out of your bag to fix a computer.
Okay.
You know, it's all there.
And it's paying no lip service to Alien versus Predator or anything like that.
Oh, that's foreboding. Yeah. Okay. That's in the bin. This is solely focused, I think, on the first two and three. And there's some wonderful nods in here to the first two films. And I would say maybe the first half of this film is more in keeping with Alien 1.
Yeah.
And the second half of this film really kind of pays homage to Aliens or Alien 2.
Okay.
But the sort of final act of this film just, it pulls the rug out completely. And instead of just setting this very much in the world of the first few films, it tries to connect it to Ridley Scott's prequels, Prometheus and Covenant.
Okay.
So that just changes the tone of the film completely. I just think it didn't work. I think it was a big swing on the director's part, and I think it was a miss.
Okay.
And the final act of this film, I mean, this is a franchise that is no stranger to some really icky, gross, kind of pseudo-sexual, you know, stuff going on. And the stuff in this really pushed the envelope.
Okay.
And this is a 15A film. And I would strongly think about, you know, who you bring to this, because the last act in particular, my mouth was sort of open a little bit. I was like, are you really doing this? You know, so it's strong. It's strong stuff at the end. It's very divisive, the ending.
Okay.
I think for the hardcore Alien franchise fans, this is really going to divide them, because they tend to fall into camps, you know, whether they like Ridley Scott's prequels or they don't.
Yeah.
And even I think for the casual viewer who's just going along, the end I think is going to be a bit sort of head scratching for some.
And when you say it's going to be divisive, as in people are going to think that it's far too much aping those prequels?
I think it's too much that there wasn't really a need to connect it back to those. Because for me anyway, what he tries to do for the first three quarters is really sit this in between Alien 1 and 2 and a perfect bridge in between those films. And I think connecting it back to the prequels does something else with it.
Okay.
And I just feel it didn't work. But up until then, it's terrific. The performances are great. Kayleigh Spaney is brilliant. She's like a pint-sized Ripley in this. She's really good. But the standout star for me is David Johnson as Andy. He is terrific in this. Really, really good. And he has a tough job in the role that he's playing. I don't want to say too much about it, but he plays it just right.
Okay.
And of course, it's wonderful to see the xenomorph back on the screen. The alien in all its glory. It's dripping, it's gooey, it's hissing, it's scary. You know, it really is.
And, you know, without giving spoilers, but one of the tropes was always aliens coming out of people's bodies. And, and it's even been, you know, the piss has been taken out of it many times and stuff. Do we have that without?
Absolutely. I mean, very much lots of nods back to that original. You remember John Hurt that time in the first one that scared the pants off us all. So really very much in keeping with that, and very viscerally done as well. I mean, it's wincing, you know.
I saw that when I was far too young to see it and frightened the life out of me.
And the thing is, probably you and I weren't old enough to see the original Alien 1 or Aliens
in the
on
cinema.
The big screen.
Yeah.
So this is a real chance to capture that kind of nostalgic vibe on the big screen, and it's done so well. And some people are going to say, oh, it's just fan service or whatever, but I think Fede Alvarez, he's a real fan of this, and he's done it very lovingly. It's not just done, you know, the way like Marvel might put in a cameo or something like that for fan service. I think he's taken a lot of trouble to do this right and get the look and feel of it just right. But the ending,
so it had you for a large part of it, but the end pulled the rug. So what are you going to say stars wise for Alien Romulus?
This was heading for Big marks, but I'm going to have to say three.
Okay, that sounds fair.
Yeah.
That sounds fair. Well, we better take a clip of Alien Romulus.
All right, this is an F-44A pulse rifle. It's rotating breech electronic pulse action. It's what the Colonial Marines used. AA stands for aiming assist. So, right, you put that under your arm. That's it. All right, this hand here. Aim it towards Andy. Pull the trigger halfway. Don't worry, the safety's on. Aiming assistance. That thing comes towards you. You point it in this general direction, you'll never miss.
Where'd you learn all this?
Games and magazines.
That is a clip from Alien Romulus, which Niamh O'Reilly, who I'm chatting to, gave three stars to. And it's in cinemas from this Friday, which, if I'm not mistaken, Niamh, is the 15th of August.
Right.
No, it's not.
No.
It's the 16th of August. Where's our calendar? We were so close. Okay, now something very different, which I have seen this week, is a movie landing on Netflix again on the 16th of August, this Friday. The Union. It is The Union.
There is the
definitive article, The Union,
yep.
Starring Halle Berry and
Mark Wahlberg.
I was going to say Danny Wahlberg there.
Because could be another brother, Wahlberg brother.
I watch a lot of Wahlbergs. So just tell people what's going on in this one.
Okay, so yeah, Mark Wahlberg is playing Mike. He's kind of, I suppose, an underachiever in life. He still lives at home with his mum. He's kind of, I don't know, late 40s. His mum is played by Lorraine Bracco.
Yeah, I know. Sopranos fame.
Her voice. Oh my God. It's nice to see her back on the screen. So lives at home with her in New Jersey, works kind of a dead end construction job, is pretty much broke, hangs out in the same bar he's probably hung out in for decades with the same people he went to high school with. So a pretty boring, you know, life. Until one day his high school sweetheart, played by Halle Berry, her name's Roxanne, she walks in the door of the bar looking fantastic, and completely out of the blue, was not expecting it, and recruits him into this clandestine agency that she works for called The Union, and kind of whisks him off to London and tries to enlist his help in an operation that went wrong that she is trying to fix, more or less.
And they want him because he's kind of
a nobody, but also actually has a good set of skills that he just never used. You know, he's kind of a non-starter in life.
But he may have hidden depths as a spy or whatever.
Yeah.
So I saw this too. What did you think of this?
It's very mid. Very, very mid. It kind of billed itself as a comedy, action comedy, rom-com. And there's nothing wrong with those. They can work really well. Look at The Fall Guy earlier this year.
Yeah.
I raved about that. I loved it. So when it's done right, it's great. I just feel like there wasn't enough here for this to be genuinely funny. And I don't think it had the budget to be sort of big on
spectacular
action. Now, there's some very good car chases in this, particularly towards the end. So it's not the worst ever. But it kind of falls between two stools for me, and there just wasn't enough substance there. But there's some good points to it. J.K. Simmons plays the leader of this clandestine organization, The Union.
Yeah.
And he's, I mean, I'd watch him in an ad.
Most people know him from The Horrible Teacher and Whiplash.
Yeah. But he's a brilliant actor.
Yeah,
now, he doesn't have a lot to do here, but he brings that, you know, level of J.K. Simmons kind of snark to it. So he's good in it. And the sets are nice. You feel like they must have got a big tax break from London. And from Croatia. Because I was watching this with my husband and we were sitting there going, God, we should go to Croatia. It's beautiful.
Mission accomplished.
The blue sea and it looked gorgeous. But I mean, in terms of kind of a solid narrative or character development, there isn't a whole lot here. The plot, to me, reminded me of the very first Mission Impossible movie. It's kind of lifted almost from that. I don't know if you remember the Knock List, which was a list of
all
of the agents who worked for whatever the agency is called, and that it slips my mind, and their real identities. So this is a similar story that's unfolding in The Union, and they have to secure it so that the covers aren't blown of agents all over the world. But it just felt very, it almost felt like a 90s TV show or something to me. It just didn't have any substance, really, or depth. There was a fair amount of chemistry, I think, between Halle Berry and Mark Wahlberg. There was a nice little interplay between them. And I was really happy to see Halle Berry on the screen again. I haven't seen her in something, you know, in a while. And she's a really good actress.
Yeah.
I think she, you know, she's had some up and downs.
Of course.
But, you know, let's not forget, she won an Oscar. You know, she really is.
She's good in this.
She
kicks ass, which is good.
She kicks ass.
Did find Mark Wahlberg kind of funny as that kid who never grew up, and the opening scene is he's with one of his school teachers, which made me laugh, I have to say.
Yeah.
But like, I'm with you for the most part. I mean, there's nothing really here. It was fine. I mean, it held my attention to the end just about, but I'm not going to be rewatching it or anything anytime soon.
It's not something I'd wish to watch again, but it's not the worst thing. I didn't feel like I had to wash my eyeballs after watching it or something.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's a mid-level popcorn no-brainer if you can't find something, you know, I'm scrolling on streaming.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not going to irritate you.
No, it isn't. It's not going to irritate you. It's not offensive in any way. It's totally fine. And the cast is quite good.
Yeah, absolutely. I also thought when Halle Berry was training Wahlberg, that was kind of funny at times.
It was. There's a funny montage in that where she's trying to get him up to speed.
And how to not
normally takes months to train these guys and he has like a week or something to do it. So, yeah.
I feel like we're those two critics out of the Muppets, Waldorf and Stoller. I hated it. Actually, wasn't that bad. I loved it. I'm not going that far, but I'm going to go first. I'd give it 2.5 stars. What would you give?
I'd say two. Okay, I'd say you're being generous. Yeah,
maybe I am. It's just the mood I'm in. So that's 2 stars and 2.5 stars retrospectively from me and Niamh O'Reilly, who's been in studio chatting about the week's new cinema releases. Thank you, Niamh.
Thanks, Mel.
Niamh O'Reilly there, reviewing The Union on Netflix and, of course, in cinemas, Alien Romulus. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'll just remind you, if you want to get in touch with me, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. All messages are read and digested. I assure you of that. I'll just remind you, the show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.